this morning, Liz and I were somewhat concerned when the service writer came through for this batch of services. Under today's heading, we said, Liz is leading, Rob is preaching. The heading, the mistake.
There's nothing like a bit of good old encouragement from Paul, is there? On reflection, we hope that the mistake he was referring to was not letting us lead and preach, but the passage that we're looking at today. Only time will tell. During the summer, Sandy and the boys and their partners decided that there was nothing quite as enjoyable in life as kayaking or paddleboarding, and so they invested in a kayak and an SUP, for the uninitiated, a stand-up paddleboard. I'll be honest with you, I have no interest whatsoever in this new pastime of theirs, and have resisted all efforts to get involved. However, what has happened on a few occasions is that Sandy and Simon have ventured out on the river from Manor Farm Country Park, heading in the direction of Curdridge, with the Horse and Jockey Pub as their destination for halfway refreshments, and then to go back afterwards to Manor Farm Country Park. And my role has simply been to meet them for halftime refreshment and then drive back to meet them at the end. Wonderful. However, what is critical to the success of such an outing is a good knowledge of the tides. On the most recent occasion, Simon and Sandy thought that they had timed it so well that the tide would be in and enable an easy passage along the river to the pub and out of the water. Now, Sandy had said to me, I'll ring you when we're about half an hour away and you'll know to get in the car and come and meet us. I didn't receive this call until a lot later than I expected, where she said, where are you? And I said, well, I'm waiting for the half hour call. I forgot about the half hour call. She didn't sound in a good mood. Basically, they passed a number of paddleboarders who seemed to be waiting at the mouth of the river as you turn towards Curdridge and the Horse and Jockey Pub. A lot of them just sort of there, just waiting, not quite sure what for. So, but Sandy and Simon decided, that's strange, and just went past them. Surely everything would be okay. They pressed on. The tide was still out. They had to push the board and the kayak through mud, haul them up onto the jetty, wade through mud, almost losing footwear in the process. For the casual observer, this was the greatest entertainment. But somehow to Sandy and Simon, this wasn't very funny. And when I got there and they were moaning about what they'd had to put up with, I said, sounds like you're over-exaggerating a bit, to which Simon said, you weren't there, Dad. Timing is crucial, isn't it? But do we ever get that sense of impatience? That sense of just wanting to get on and do something when perhaps waiting, just waiting, would be the best option. Last week we saw Astrid remind us of the folly of a nation who wanted to be like the surrounding nations. It wasn't enough to have judges wired into God's plans to guide the nation. They wanted a king. They were reminded of what their actions would result in, and yet still they asked for a king. It would be fair to say that the first year with Saul as their king could be considered to be a honeymoon period. But then the problems came. We're going to read from 1 Samuel, chapter 13, verses 1 to 15. If you've got a pew Bible there, it might be helpful to have it with you as we look through that this morning. So Saul, 1 Samuel, chapter 13, verses 1 to 15. Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel for 42 years. Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel. 2,000 were with him at Michmash, and in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. The rest of the men he sent back to their homes. Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost at Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. Then Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, "Let the Hebrews hear." So all Israel heard the news, Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost, and now Israel has become an offence to the Philistines. And the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal. The Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They went up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that their situation was critical and that their army was hard-pressed, they hid in caves, thickets, among the rocks, and in pits and cisterns. Some Hebrews even crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. He waited for 7 days, the time set by Samuel. But Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings." And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. "What have you done?" asked Samuel. Saul replied, "When I saw that the men were scattering, and that you didn't come at the set time, and the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favour. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering." "You acted foolishly," Samuel said. "You've not kept the commands the Lord your God gave you. If you had, you would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." Then Samuel left Gilgal and went up to Gibeah and Benjamin, and Saul counted the men who were with him. They numbered about 600. You know, I have to say, if we take the reading this morning at face value, one could be minded to feel that God was overly harsh on Saul. Here was a man who had waited patiently for Samuel to arrive, and in the absence of Samuel, felt he had to exhibit some sort of leadership. We can see the fear already creeping into his troops. As it tells us in verse 8, they began to scatter. Saul needed to do something to revitalize his troops, to show he was in command of the situation. Surely this was someone just trying to make the best out of a bad situation. The problem is, the more we delve into the passage, we see the folly of a nation in their desire for a king is brought home to roost with the actions of a king who had become perhaps overinflated with his own importance, swept up with the hype of being the ruler, and therefore was becoming clouded in his judgments. Usually, it can take many years for someone in power to become puffed up and full of their own importance. But we're reliably informed that this chapter is played out 1 or 2 years into the leadership of Saul. We don't know how much had happened in that first year, or if anything particular happened, but perhaps one can surmise that Saul was wallowing in the afterglow of the people's desire for a king having been achieved. Soaking up the adulation, perhaps. But in the second year, we see him exerting his authority, making strategic decisions with regard to his troops. He specifically chooses 3,000 men, of which he commands 2,000 and 1,000 to Jonathan. I find the striking thing here is that he sent the rest of his men back home, back to their homes. And I'll tell you why I find that strange in a minute. It seemed that up to this point that the Israelites were no real threat to the Philistines. As long as they kept themselves to themselves, didn't make too many waves, they were fairly safe as a nation from the wrath of the Philistines. And yet, when Jonathan attacks this outpost. This grabbed their attention. Why, if this was going to happen, did Saul send so many of his men home? Strange decision. It's interesting that Saul, who was not at this battle, seemed to take great delight in basking in the glory of it, having the trumpet blown throughout the land, making a big noise about the triumph. Do we ever enjoy the afterglow of someone else's triumphs? As a Saints fan, probably not. Now, you all know me to be a reluctant runner. I often say I love running because I really love food. You know, it's very rare for me to bask in the glow of any of my running achievements. Because let's face it, they're pretty lame. So it is somewhat easy sometimes to enjoy the running exploits of Jacob, my son. Sometimes when I park run and he's flying round, I must admit to my shame, I may have uttered the phrase, chip off the old block there, taught him everything he knows. To be fair, most people turn round and say, really? Look at yourself, Rob. Look at Jacob. You taught him everything he knows. I don't think so. And it is total rubbish. I've never been anywhere near his speed of running. And I must admit, he continues to teach me everything that I ought to know about running. Did you do those warm-ups that I told you about, Dad? Did you do the warm-down afterwards like you should have done? You still doing those stretches I told you about, Dad? As much as I might want to bask in his triumphs, it's all him, not me. But here we see Saul, rather overcome with this foolish bravado and cocksure confidence, blowing the trumpet, heralding this success with his 3,000 troops. So he was engulfed in the moment, lapping up his own importance. And perhaps his judgment was clouded. Didn't he think that the Philistines would bring retribution? And in a speedy and fast way. Israel had an army, but clearly it was currently only limited to small victories, sorties as it were. And they had rattled the cage of the Philistines. And boy, were they rattled. What does it tell us about the army they assembled? You know, we're thinking of the 3,000 that Saul had. And it tells us the Philistines, 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. And I imagine this is the critical point where the Israelites were probably reminded of the words of warning from God about having a king. In the midst of the gathering storm from the Philistines with an army that dwarfed the Israelites, what did they do? Where they previously had looked to Samuel for God's direction, where would they look now? Did they have the confidence in their king who had so bravely rattled the cage of the Philistines? Seems they abandoned all hope. We don't even hear any commentary of them turning to Saul for his words of wisdom. We don't hear of them crying out to God for salvation in this dark hour. No, essentially, they hid. And verses 6 and 7 show us their desperation. Basically, it's saying they hid wherever they could find. Caves, thickets, among rocks, in pits and cisterns. Now, I admit to having looked up whether a cistern in the Bible was similar to today's meaning. They were hiding in cisterns. And it says, essentially, a receptacle for water conveyed to it. Reservoir, so to speak, something like that. Empty cisterns were sometimes used as prisons. The pit that Joseph was cast into was essentially a dry well, or a cistern. They were basically looking for anywhere that they might be safe from this impending massacre. How quickly the honeymoon period had ended, and Saul begins to see his 3,000 men that he had chosen heavily depleted. Such was the desperation, some even tried crossing the Jordan to escape their fate. And what about those that remained? Those brave soldiers that remained? They were literally quaking with fear. I don't know about you, but Have you ever been so frightened or scared that you were quaking with fear? The nearest I can think of it for me, and I'll be honest with you, you know, we often think that we're in control of our lives and we've got things sorted. There have been one or two times in my life when I've literally had a panic attack. Something has got the better of me and I have had a panic attack. And that's the closest I can think of this. That sheer shaking and fear and hyperactive tension of, I'm not in control here. I am so not in control. And this was the case for the soldiers. So those that remained would have been good for nothing. They were quaking with fear. 1 can only imagine how they felt in this situation. And yet, for those that remained, they had to wait. They had to wait for Samuel to arrive to make offerings to God, as was his duty. And you can imagine this delay only adding to the tension and the fear of the Israelites. And I wonder about the emotions going through Saul. He was a king. And yet the delay at the moment was down to the responsibility that still sat with Samuel. Only priests and Levites could carry out this ceremony, and Saul could only sit and wait. And he was watching his men scatter. The same who'd called for a king and been granted one, now their king seemed to be a king of inaction, in his opinion. Unable to deal with the issue. And so he makes this judgment call as soon as he can, when it gets to 7 days. He's going to go ahead with this ceremony himself. One would perhaps have had some respect for Saul if there appeared to be any prayer involved before he undertook this ceremony. But for all this chapter, God seems to be strangely absent from his thoughts or his actions. The ceremony seemed nothing more than a routine go-through, basically going through the motions. It was the done thing, but he had no understanding that it was that acknowledgement being made that God was Lord. He was just doing a job that had to be done. It's fair to say sometimes our lives can become just a succession of going through the motions. Going to church, because that's what we do on a Sunday. Reading the Bible, but not letting it speak to us. Maybe a well-known piece of scripture that we know so well, and our familiarity with it fools us into thinking we won't learn anything new from this today. We almost fall into that mistake of thinking, do you know, we have our lives under control and God becomes less relevant to us. Do you know, the sad thing is, even when Samuel turns up and asks Saul what he has done, there doesn't appear to be any remorse for his actions. He seeks to justify a decision by pushing the blame back on Samuel. You didn't come at the set time, did you? What was I supposed to do? He rolls out the reasons why he came to the conclusion that he had to do what he had to do. The men were scattering, the Philistines were assembling. You weren't here at the set time. What was I supposed to do? I did this. Saul had essentially taken the matter into his own hands. Last week we had a nation wanting a king and looking to human leadership at the expense of God. This week we see the appointed king foolishly believing that his decision making was sufficient for the Israelite people. After all, he was king. Was this one foolish mistake that provoked a hugely overblown response from God through Samuel? I don't think so. We can already see as we go through the chapter that God appeared to be constantly outside of the events as far as Saul was concerned in his decision making. Do you know, I love the stories in the Bible where men and women of God constantly prayed into every situation that they were in. They wanted God at the centre of their lives, the centre of their decisions, so that everything gave glory to him. A particular favourite of mine is Nehemiah, bringing prayers to the Lord every situation, then moving forward confident that his God was with him. To be fair, God was starting to be out of the picture during the honeymoon period for Saul, and this was the last in a line of decisions where God appears to have been excluded. In Samuel 10, verse 8, Samuel had given clear instructions to wait for 7 days in Gilgal. He had told Saul about this. So Saul going ahead with this offering was in direct disobedience to Samuel and to God. And the cost is so dear for Saul. His kingdom will not endure. His actions will not only affect him, but they affect his children and their children. It's a sad thing, isn't it, that our actions can sometimes have such long-lasting effects. Many of you will remember a jeweller's chain from the 1980s called Ratner's. The owner of the company, Gerald Ratner, had rode on a sea of success. His stores were numerous. They were a household name. The man was regarded as having the Midas touch. His company was doing exceptionally well. And with this Midas touch came confidence and an air of bravado. So much so that when addressing a conference to the Institute of Directors in April 1991, he made the following comment. And I won't use the exact word he said at the end of it, but you'll get the gist. He said in this conference, where the press were as well, "You know, we also do cut glass sherry decanters, complete with 6 glasses on a silver plated tray that your butler can serve you drinks on, all for £4.95. People say, how can you sell this for such a low price? I say, because it's total rubbish." And after the speech that he made, the value of the Ratner Group plummeted by around £500 million. Less than 50 words brought a man and his company to his knees. The actions that day of that man completely turned around where that company was and where that company was going. Our actions can change the course of people's lives. And if we're not reliant and dependent on God for our direction, for our actions, and they're not of God, they can be ultimately harmful to ourselves and those around us, and can have far-reaching effects. That's quite depressing, isn't it? But let's flip that. Our actions and our words, if they're of God, can transform lives, can bring people from darkness into light, can change towns, cities, nations, if what we are doing is of God and we have sought God's direction. Last week we saw the nation swayed by the need for a king. We see this week a king blinded by his own importance, making rash decisions with God out of the loop and having to reap the consequences. And yet, how many of us can relate to Saul? Let's face it, none of us have had the ultimate responsibility of Saul as a king, unless you'd like to share with me this morning that you have been king of a nation somewhere. But it's a timely reminder that in each and every one of our lives, especially when things are going bad, and we wonder why there seems to be inaction, or that there is a particular thing and a particular route that's happening in somebody's life that we love, it would be easy to try and sort it out from our own understanding. But as we're reminded here, it's about coming before God on our knees and asking for his direction, for his protection, and the way forward. Has church and God just become routine in our lives, the thing we have to do, like Saul did with those offerings? Have we just got used to making the decisions ourselves and somehow thinking we can wing it? Has that been a process which started some time ago and we now find ourselves wondering why we're struggling, wondering why things aren't going as perhaps we would like them to go? How many feel this morning that it's got to the point where you're like perhaps one of the Israelites? Are you cowering in the cave, realizing that it's been folly to do things under your own power? I always find there's a song, Holy Spirit, We Welcome You. And I always find that song a lovely song. And I love to have it at the start of services. But I also find it exceptionally challenging. And it's because of one word in that song. And that says, unreservedly, have your way, Lord. In this situation, Saul needed to be saying, unreservedly, have your way, God. You be the one making the decisions here, not me. But that's a big word to say in a song, unreservedly. That's just laying down everything and saying, God, you're in control here. Please sort the situation out. Sort me out. When humanly speaking, the situation looks irretrievable. When we're in the fiercest storm, the temptation might be to run to the caves like Corporal Jones shouting, don't panic, Captain Mannering. But let us call to God to unreservedly have his way. I pray this morning that he may be our strength, our cornerstone, so we can say that our hope is built on nothing less than his blood and righteousness. Shall we sing our final song?